CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 150, with Dr. Keith Walter, the groundbreaking study leading to LASIK approval. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today, I got a very special guest. We got Dr. Keith Walter from Wake Forest University. Keith, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks, Uday. Love being here.
Hey, I want to talk to you about, you've done some really, really groundbreaking instrumental work. Like, you were part of the original LASIK study out of Emory.
Yeah, that's
literally, you studied, got it approved, right?
Yeah, 1995, yeah. 30 years ago.
Oh my God, don't say it's 30 years. Oh, you're right, it's 30 years.
30 years, yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit, like, what was, so you did your med school at Duke, and then you did your residency and fellowship at Emory. In the early and mid-90s, Emory was like the powerhouse, the center of refractive surgery, period.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, you know, George Waring III was faculty there when I was faculty. Mostly when I was a resident, he was in Saudi Arabia, like learning the LASIK stuff from Pellicoris and, you know, figuring out what we're going to do and bring it to the United States. So, you know, they were doing all kinds of weird flap and zap stuff. They were sometimes doing a flap and zapping the flap because they thought that might be better than, you know, for the endothelium. They thought that they should protect the endothelium from the eczema. So they were doing that stuff. And then ALK, I don't know if you remember, they were making two cuts with the microkeratome to try to control, you know, but of course the second cut was mechanical and not very precise. So then that's when they decided, you know, the eczema laser was going to be a better option, but do it in the bed. And then he brought it. When I was a fellow, he was back full time. And that's when the Emory Eye Center started doing all these, you know, FDA studies. They had just done the PRK one before that. I think that was around 93. And then that's when I was a resident. When I was a fellow, they were doing the LASIK one.
Right. Even before that, they did the PERK study of radial keratotomy.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I still have George Waring's book somewhere. I think I use it as a paperweight now. But there's a book, no lie, this thick on RK, just RK. And it was written by George Waring. Crazy.
Right. I mean, that was even more reason that Emory was like the powerhouse. You did the first at that time, RK was considered like, wow, how can you do this at a university?
Yeah.
Right? It was a practice kind of thing. But then RK, then the PRK studies, then the LASIK studies. It was really amazing. You also had, who are the other faculty members there? It's kind of skipped my mind. Doyle Stalting too.
Yep. Doyle was one of my mentors as well. Yeah. Keith Thompson. I don't know if you remember Keith Thompson was there. You know, Robert Maloney was a fellow just before I started my residency. So Robert Maloney was there and, you know, also got a taste of refractive surgery from Emory. And then let's see, Lou Wilson was kind of the older senior faculty, about to be emeritus when I was a resident. So he was barely hanging on. But it was those main three, George, Keith, and, Doyle that were doing the refractive stuff.
Yeah, and then wow, this really amazingly, yeah, was FDA approved 30 years. I guess study was 30 years ago. Maybe it was approved shortly thereafter, right?
Yeah, I think it was 95. I think it was 95 or 96 it got approved. It was right around there.
Wow. So yeah, some things I didn't even think about, like, yeah, doing the ablation on the underside of the flap. Like, it didn't even cross my mind.
Yeah. And they did a thicker flap too. You know, they used to do like a 200 micron flap. And, you know, back in those days, too, we were doing everybody. We didn't really know that maybe we shouldn't do thin corneas. So or make a cornea too thin. So I remember doing like minus 16s or 15s with LASIK.
Yeah.
Back in the day.
Yeah.
They were doing everybody walked in. So.
Yeah. There was the old trick. You double card on the machine. So you can do, you know, minus 10 and then you put another card in and you do minus 8.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what they would do, double card. And then one real quick story. I remember the first time I ever knew or heard of or came up with DLK, diffuse lamellar keratitis, right? Well, Doyle Stolting, when I was a fellow, had a bilateral case. And at that time, nobody knew what it was. He thought the person was going to go blind from bilateral infectious keratitis. And so he had a microbiology lab set up, and this is how anal Doyle was. He had a microbiology lab set up in the office. And so he would do his own Gram stain And he had me lifting these flaps and doing Gram stains like every hour because he was convinced it was bacterial. So this poor LASIK patient, he had like DLK stage 3 or whatever it was. And he was making me do all these Gram stains and we're running them back. Couldn't find anything, just white cells everywhere. And then eventually just irrigated the flaps with a bunch of antibiotics and hope for the best. And it wasn't until later we found out it was, you know, of course we found out it was sterile at that time, but we didn't really understand what it was or how it happened. But I remember that was like, he was freaking out about it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, people don't realize in the early days, the pioneers went through a lot to bring it to where it is today.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's crazy.
I remember doing LASIK as a resident in the maybe 1999 and pushing that mechanical, it wasn't even motorized. You
right. Pushed
this mechanical, you know, ACS keratome across the eye, and like just hoped when it retracted, I hope the eye's intact. I hope the flap's still there.
Yeah. Yeah. I used to joke, I used to do it like this.
Yeah, looking away.
Yeah, okay.
That was, even when we got, you know, to the mechanical mark keratomes that had like the motorized one, that was just stressful. When that keratome passed across the cornea, you blocks your entire view. I'm just thinking, like, please let this be normal.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it did block your view, and sometimes it would run over the eyelid, and maybe it would cut lashes, but maybe it would cut eyelid. I mean, it was crazy.
Right,
we did.
Yeah, and that's what taught me to do a really good job of draping. You better get every lash out of the way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Because now you're the youngster using femto to make your flap. You don't know how lucky you are.
Yeah, right. I give a lecture to the residents, and I always teach them there's like, I think there's 12 complications that really don't exist with the femto that used to exist with the microkeratome. I mean, like incomplete flaps, buttonholes. You got like ingrowth like crazy because, you know, that was just a side cut, you know, with the femto, it's deep vertically before it goes horizontal and you don't get the ingrowth. Like, you know, we don't see that anymore. We really don't.
Yeah.
And we see it all the time, especially on hyperopes or enhancements. But yeah, buttonhole flaps were a big issue. Flap too small, flap amputated, free flap. Hinge too small and the hinge would slide around and you'd get, you know, slip flaps and you'd have to refloat them and put them back on, or sometimes you had to stitch them down. I mean, with the precision of the femto, we don't see any of that anymore. Really, it annihilated a lot of those risks.
Yeah, I was doing LASIK cases yesterday and it was just like so low stress.
Yeah, it's fun. I think LASIK is fun.
It's a ton of fun.
Yeah, but and they get great results, you know, so, you know, people are super happy the next day. So it's good.
Yeah, that's for sure. And I've done it to my patients, don't do the cover one eye, cover the other eye comparison. I said, it's bad for your brain. It prevents the brain from syncing the two images. Don't do it ever.
Yeah, that's what I tell them too. I tell them it's bad to do this. Or a lot of times I make fun of them. I say, did you do that before surgery? And they're like, no, why? I'm like, well, why are you doing it now? Your eyes work together.
That's like, a good, very good point.
You don't put your contacts in, then go like this. Like, just let it go. And you, and then, I was going to say, the other thing I tell people is like, yeah, there's always a little difference in our eyesight, you know, just like a difference in our hands, the way they're, you know, dominant or non-dominant, or maybe a little different size. Like, it's okay to be asymmetric.
Yeah. I tell them, your eyes are sisters, not identical twins.
Yeah, that's right.
You also published a really important study about 20 years ago that was such like an, that makes sense moment, which is about humidity in the operating room while doing LASIK. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So, you know, again, that's another thing that's changed over time. Our enhancement rate's gone way down. You know, I remember some of the first publications that was like 16, 17, 20% enhancement rate. And that was considered okay, normal. So we'd always be taking these patients back. And what I noticed over the course of a year or two, that it seemed to be seasonal. Like I would go months. I had a pretty steady LASIK volume every month. But certain times of the year, I noticed I was doing a lot more enhancements during that time of the year. And we always made them wait like 3 months. So I started looking back, well, what was going on 3 months ago when we were doing these LASIK patients that were seeing all these enhancements? And they're almost always under corrections. And so when you look back 3 months before, they were all done in the summer, in the most humid time of, you know, North Carolina, when its humidity is 98%. And I figured, you know, we know that the laser has to go through cornea tissue, and there's water in the cornea tissue. And if it's overly hydrated, you'll get undercorrections. Like if you lift the flap and there's tears everywhere, you'll not have a good result as you wipe it. And so the thought was, well, maybe it's going through a column of humid air, and that's also somehow blocking the laser. And so that's what we looked at, and then kind of started looking at our humidity, and it correlated pretty well with, you know, the outside humidity, or at least the indoor humidity, whatever. Because, you know, back then too, we didn't really climate control that well our lasers. You know, we kind of just did whatever. I remember the lasers getting really hot in there too, like it would just kind of go way up. And so now they're all climate controlled and much better. And now, you know, I don't know what your enhancement rate is, but I'm sure it's less than 1%. It's almost zero, you know, it's really tiny.
Yeah, we've come a long way. I remember LA is kind of the opposite, where it's very, very dry. It's always 10% humidity or less.
Yeah.
And patients here in certain part of town, like in the valley here, would be 100 degrees Fahrenheit or like 37 Celsius and super low humidity. And so the laser would, quote, run too hot.
Yeah.
All you get overcorrections. End up being overcorrected.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. We saw that too. We had an opposite problem when it was really dry. Like winter was for us, you know, everything gets really cold and there's no humidity in the winter. Everything dries up, static electricity everywhere and all that. But yeah, it seems like we improved on those things after that.
Now it's common sense. Of course you have to control the humidity, but I assure you 20 years ago, before you made your study, no one thought of it.
Yeah. No, we didn't think about it. Like I said, not even temperature control. You know, now even like the catalyst laser, you know, your other femtosecond lasers are climate controlled too. Like they'll shut down if it gets out of a certain range because they know that it's not going to treat the patient the same. Right. So yeah, it's interesting.
So tell me about the way you're doing LASIK now. So what laser are you using in your situation, your clinic?
We have the Alcon platform, the FS200, and then the EX500. And we're using Contura pretty much anytime we can on most every patient if we can. And I love it. It's been great. It's been awesome.
Yeah, I use the same Alcon Exmer. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Tell me about, are you doing any Presby LASIK?
No, we were looking into that. You know, they have Presby LASIK in Europe. You know, they have machines that can control the Q factor and kind of make an extra prolate cornea, or even like a bimodal kind of prolate cornea. And I actually originally had a patent on it, and we were doing double cards for that, because that's another thing I noticed, and you probably noticed this too, when you did get those overcorrections and you had to come back and do a hyperopic ablation on your previous myopic patient, a lot of those 40-year-olds or 45-year-olds would be like, hey, you know what? Not only did you fix my distance vision, but I can read again. And I'd be like, really? They're like, yeah, it's great. And when you do their topography, and they have kind of almost a little bit of a central island. But, you know, they didn't have a central island after the first ablation, but you could see a little bit of a, I call it like a sombrero look to it. It didn't look quite, you know, normal, but they were happy. So that kind of led me, we did a study where we double carded people, and it came out okay. We had a definite correlation, but my problem, when you do double card like that, it's really hard to control the two center, at least back then, the two ablations to be perfectly centered on top of each other.
Yeah.
And so I thought we got good results when they were exactly on top of each other, but if they were a little askew, and of course you're double carding, so there's a little bit of downtime before you get the next, you know, ablation on there. I thought we could do it better if I could get a company just to write software that would do the presbyopic correction, basically a double card automatically. And it kind of never took off. I think a lot of, like, you know, talked to Alcon about it and a bunch of other companies, and they were sort of interested, but I think they realized it was a big expense to do that and get an FDA approval. And then, you know, I don't know how it's doing in Europe, but I've heard it's still working pretty well. I think it's the, I can't remember what laser it is that does it in Europe, but it's approved for Presby LASIK. There's like Presby Beyond, another one that they do. There's
The Schwinn laser, the Schwinn Ameris laser.
Schwinn, yeah, that's what it is. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting stuff. I mean, there are two schools. I mean, the schools are either you do it like zonal, where central can be distance power or central can be near power.
Yeah.
Or you can do it like you were saying, change the asphericity, the Q factor.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting, these concepts. I mean, obviously it works to a degree.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. And I think you probably notice this too, even your myopic LASIK patients, I'm one of those, you know, I'm 60 now and I didn't really start needing reading glasses until I was probably 52 or 53. Because I think, you know, even just a good prolate ablation on your cornea buys you a little bit of a multifocal cornea. So, you know, it seems like a lot of our LASIK patients, and yours too, I'm sure, had that delayed presbyopic symptoms. You know, normally it'd be 40, 42, you'd be reading glasses, but a lot of the good myopic LASIK ablations that are 20/20 at distance have a little bit of help up close.
Sure.
Maybe it's a diopter or something. That's it.
Yeah, I've noticed that too, for sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Are you doing mostly LASIK, or are you also doing any corneal lenticular extractions, like SMILE?
No, I'm not doing any SMILE. I never bought into SMILE. You know, that first FDA study came out and it was only like 86% or 88% were 20/20 or better.
Yeah.
And then I thought, well, what do we do with those 12% that aren't 20/20 or better? I mean, you're going to have to do an enhancement. And then how do you do the enhancement? Oh, then you take out the excimer, I guess, and do a PRK on top. You know, that I didn't like that sales job. I didn't know how I was going to explain that to patients. And like you were talking about earlier, we're getting such good results with LASIK. And then again, at a university, if you want to buy a $500,000 piece of equipment, you better have a good reason to do it, and you better use it a lot, you know. And our LASIK volume, I'm sure, you know, a lot of people in the country told me this, that their LASIK volume is kind of slowed down. Yeah. So we weren't doing as many cases. So I couldn't really justify getting a SMILE type machine.
Yeah, so, even I mean, I've got access to it. I get the laser right there, but I still prefer LASIK.
Yeah. Yeah. And then LASIK, you can do Contura and you can do some higher cylinder pretty easily. And of course you can do hyperopes with it, you know, so it has its, you know, definite advantages over SMILE, I think.
Yeah, for sure. And then it's also like great track record, and I could be like 99%+ accurate, bam, right out of the gates.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So yeah, that's definitely something that the young generation just, you guys are so fortunate. I just wish we had this stuff years ago. The amount of grief we had to go through. You brought up some memories about when we did the micarto flaps, because the edge of the flap is infinitely thin.
Yeah.
You get all the time, you're getting epithelial ingrowth.
All the time. All the time. Especially on hyperopes, you know, because you're ablating that edge too. Right. So you're actually making it easy for the epithelium to grow under the flap. And yeah, you know, you just don't see that anymore with the femto. It's just like, yeah, gone. Even on enhancements where you could be at higher risk for ingrowth, like you were with the microkeratome, I don't even see a touch-up femto flap getting ingrowth. It's just not there anymore.
It's just that's something we just don't have to worry about. I was looking at some of my old papers that some articles I wrote. One was about using a YAG laser to treat epithelial ingrowth.
Oh yeah,
little residual. And I'm just like, God, I haven't done that in 20 years now.
Yeah. Yeah. So I got a lady right now, and I did her LASIK probably 25 years ago with a microkeratome. She did great. She was mountain biking and hit her eye with a twig and dislodged her flap a little bit. Then she started getting ingrowth. So 20 years ago, or whatever, I can't remember how long after her LASIK, it was a few years after her LASIK, I took out the epithelium, put her flap back down. She did great, got a little bit, you know, maybe a millimeter, just left it alone. It wasn't encroaching. She comes back to me, you know, 15, 20 years later, and she's got a cyst, a huge cyst in her flap. It grew and it bubbled up and got into her visual axis. So I had to relift it and take it out. Thought I cured her, and then that was probably 6 or 8 months ago, maybe longer. She comes back, it's all back again.
Oh my goodness.
So I mean, I either gonna have to suture her flap.
Yeah.
And her flap edge is kind of thin and ratty, and you know, sometimes it kind of curls under a little bit, or it looks a little, you know, melted on the edges. So I'm gonna take off the flap. I think that's the answer, is to do a lamellar keratectomy and just take the flap off and let epithelium grow back over. And I don't know if you've ever done that, but Carl Stonecipher and I, you know, Carl's my neighbor, and we've had a couple mutual cases where he's done one for me, I've done one for him. And that, if it's with a microkeratome, because it is like a planar flap, you can get away with it, and they actually have really good vision. And it takes a while.
Interesting.
Yeah, it doesn't change the refractive error. Like what? That old.
That's so counterintuitive to me.
Yeah, because the flap's exactly the same thickness all the way across. It's thinner on the edges, right? But when you take it off, the center part, once it re-epithelializes, they have a thinner cornea, but it's the same curvature, or really close.
Wow.
And then guess what? They can't get ingrowth anymore after that.
I've never done the flap keratectomy. I've just never had that patient. Or I prefer it, I'm out. I'm just shocked that the refractive error doesn't change much. Because then I think they probably end up with some crazy refractive error. Then you got to do their IOL surgery to fix that.
Yeah. No, it's all good.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, N of maybe 5 or 6 between Carl and I, but they've all done well. It's rare. Luckily, it's really rare that you have to go to that extreme. But yeah, some of these recalcitrant, you know, recurrent ingrowth, you know, do you want to just keep putting sutures in the flap, or, you know, and then they still get it on some place, you know, it makes sense, you know, if you think about it.
No, I totally makes sense now. How often are you, so you obviously do the full spectrum of everything refractive. So you're doing obviously corneal refractive, you probably do phakic lenses, cataract, IOL surgery, the works.
Yeah. 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 Doing a lot of, cataract refractive type stuff. So, you know, again, that was a natural for guys like us to, when they started changing cataract surgery to more of a refractive procedure, you know, and that's been great. Again, I have the Catalyst laser. I like to use that for low amounts of astigmatism. Mm-hmm. You know, I think Gary Wartz has shown now a couple times that doing small incisions for correction of astigmatism, because, you know, our IOLs in the U.S., the toric IOLs don't go low enough to treat like 0.75 or even 1 diopter, really. So you can use a laser and get really good results with that. And then, of course, with the multifocal lenses out there nowadays, you know, the trifocals, all the newer ones are just, you know, doing great. Panoptix is doing great. Odyssey's doing great. Give great vision. So it's been a nice thing to have.
Yeah, patients are really happy with the results of the refractive cataract. That's come a long way. That's obviously overtaken LASIK by, you know, a large factor.
Yep, same. Yeah, same here. Yeah, I do way more Odysseys and refractive cataract surgery than I do LASIK nowadays. You know, it's like LASIK for the really young people, and then anyone else, you know, I do a couple of clear lens exchanges here and there. I don't do a whole lot, but, you know, the right candidate, I'll do it. I just did one the other day. He was like a +2 hyperope. Used to see great, you know, when he was younger, because he was late in hyperope, right? And then he had to wear bifocals when he turned 50, and he was 60, but didn't really have any cataract to speak of. And so I told him what we could do, and he's like, do it. First day, he's like, they did bilateral surgery. Mm-hmm. It's all cash pay, right? And he was like, this is great. The best thing ever.
Yeah, those hyperopes are so motivated. I love it.
Yeah, very motivated.
I thought refractive lens exchange, kind of the danger, are the ones who are just early presbyopes. Let's say a 50-year-old, 52-year-old, who's a plano presbyope, emmetropic.
Yeah.
Picture reading vision, you put a multifocal in, they're not so happy.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause they had a little better reading vision maybe than what you just gave them, and less distraction.
Right. Yeah.
Or even the myopes, the low myopes are kind of troublesome because, you know, if they're a -3, they're just so used to taking off their glasses and seeing great. Mm-hmm. And then you took that away from them. They do okay. You have to be really careful on those, and also a little higher risk for retinal attachment if they're just a clear lensectomy, you know. So I kind of steer away from those. But if they got a cataract and they're not seeing well and they're -3, I think, and they want to keep their reading vision and still get distance, then I think that's the way to go.
Yeah, for sure. Sure. Certainly once the cataract kicks in, especially because these trifocals have about that +3 add, which is like perfect for them.
Yeah. Yeah. So that works out okay.
Now, in your practice, you do obviously all the refractive stuff, but you're also still doing corneal work like DSAC, DMEC.
Yeah. Yeah. We're still doing that. So I don't do any PKA just as I've gotten older. I think I haven't done a full thickness transplant in the last probably 5 years, but my partners still do them. And that, you know, I used to, when I first started at Wake, I was doing probably 2 PKs a week because my predecessor, who was retiring, handed his practice over to me, and he was the only guy in North Carolina basically doing PKs besides Kobo at Duke. And So he had the entire half of the North Carolina and some Virginia and in the surrounding area. So I was doing a ton of PKs. And then, you know, once we got DSEC, you know, and we got better treatments for keratoconus, all of a sudden the PK volume just went way down, and which is good. It's a good thing, right? It's a good thing. And I just started doing mostly, you know, Fuchs patients in DSECs, or I would do a DSEC under a PK on the failed grafts. And right. So, and then with keratoconus, a lot of those people got cross-linking or intacts there for a while, and they were doing okay, or, you know, fit them in scleral lenses too nowadays. And now we have CTAC for them. So I think we're going to see keratoconus incidence of needing a PK drop kind of dramatically as well.
Right.
So that's a good thing too. But yeah, I still do a fair number of just EKs of all kinds. And then we're involved in the cell therapy study. I don't know if you know about that.
Well, tell me about it.
Yeah, so it turns out in Japan, they've been doing it for probably 8 years, and it's now approved by their insurance. And they've been doing it. We've been doing some studies in South America, and we're in phase 3 studies in the United States now, where basically you can grow a bunch of healthy cells. You get one donor, okay. And you grow a bunch of cells in a lab. You can multiply those cells thousands and thousands of times. They're healthy cells. They're HLA neutral. There's no antigens on them. And then you can take those cells, take a patient to the OR, brush away their decimate or their endothelial cells, leaving decimase behind, and just squirt in a bunch of cells, have them lay face down for 3 hours, and then that's it. You give them steroids for a month, and then in about 2 months, they're seeing better than a DMEC.
Wow, that's wild.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a company called Aurion, A-U-R-I-O-N, and there's another one, I can't remember their name, but they're trying to get this, you know, pushed through the FDA so we can be doing this for our patients. So that means, if that's true, we're probably not going to, it's working great. They've got great, great results with this. Very few complications, if any. The patients aren't on steroids forever. They're not worried about rejection. And these people are incredibly happy with it. So, and it's better than like DSO or decimate stripping only. It's better than any of those other, you know, modalities that we've tried in the past. So we're probably not going to be doing much DSEC or DMEC in the next, I would say in 5 years, we're probably not going to be doing much DSEC or DMEC in the United States.
Wow, that's the game changer.
Yeah. So
you also invented that endocerter, right? That
was yeah, you. No. So I'm losing that. Huh?
You're losing out. What are you doing? You shoot yourself in the foot here.
I know, right? We're getting these cells. I invented the endocerter. Gosh, that's been. We have two versions. The first version was probably 20 years ago, or close to that. Yeah, it was right early on when DSEC first started. So it was about 18, 19 years ago, probably. Got that FDA approved, and that's done really well. Of course, it's a niche market, you know, not many transplants are done even with that in the United States, but it did well. And then we came out a few years ago with a preloaded version.
Yeah.
The tissue can be loaded in advance, cut to your size, diameter, thickness wise, you can just order it up, which is nice because then you don't have to worry about fumbling with tissue to load it or trying to cut your own tissue in the OR.
Yeah. The few that I've done, I like them preloaded. I want them preloaded, cut the way I want it. I want them stained. I want them, you know, direction marked. Just line it up for me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's why I like them too. Yeah, it works. And it's been working great. It's been nice.
For the cell injection, I guess, do you put more cells than you need and then just kind of see what sticks?
Yeah, I guess that 3 hours of face down, the cells by gravity just naturally will start sticking to the, and there's no bubble in the eye. There's nothing like that. They start sticking to the, you know, prepared bed, let's call it. And then they're edematous for a while. But so you think, oh, my God, what do we do? But then they slowly start spreading out and growing and connecting together. And they can lay down new decimase even. And then the edema goes away and they start seeing really clearly. And then when you look at them, you can't even tell. Although it's interesting, some of them still will have guttata for a while. Like, you know, because that's, you're not taking off decimase, you're leaving decimase, and the little bumps are still there. Mm. But but it doesn't seem to interfere with their vision, and they eventually settle down themselves. But the edema goes away, which is usually the main reason they're not seeing right away.
What kind of cell count do we end up achieving? They're like 2,000 cells per square millimeter?
You know, I don't remember. I know we did the study. I don't remember what the average was. But yeah, it's a healthy number. It's not like, you know, 4,000 cells or whatever. We were dreaming, you know, like big. Like we could probably put 5,000 cells in there. You know, it'd have to be super dense. But I think it's around 2,000. I think that's a good guess if I remember
that's
right.
Great.
Yeah.
Total game changer.
Yeah. You know, like in the PK studies, the most of those graphs that were out even 20 or 30 years, when they do their cell counts, some of them only have 900 cell counts.
Yeah.
And they're still clear. So it turns out you probably don't need that many cells to make a cornea happy, that dense of cells. You just need good working cells, right? And so, you know, probably a population of, or density of 900 to 1,000 is probably all you need, really.
If we have the cells good, right?
Yeah, if the cells are happy and working well.
So do you get to teach all this to residents too? Or I know you there at Wake Forest, you've got a great residency, like in terms of great surgical volume.
Yeah, we have 4 residents per year. We started with 2. And when I was here, you know, 30 years ago, we've grown up to 4. We probably could use 5. Some of our residents get over 300 cataracts pretty easily. I think most of them do. I think one last year got almost 400. So we have a couple of VAs they can go to, and then we also have our own private clinics that they do surgery out of as well. So yeah, they get great experience. We're real proud of our residents. They've done wonderful jobs and done great, you know, going around all over the country. So it's been a good experience teaching them.
Yeah, it's a big growth. So you doubled from 2 a year to 4 a year. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, we probably could use 5 because, you know, we get a lot of ruptured globes. I don't know what it is, but we are a mecca for ruptured globes. So my fellow, I have a cornea fellow as well too. And we've had cornea fellows probably for 15 years, just one fellow per year, but he'll get tons of experience as well. But like ruptured globes are always, every fellow comes in, I can't believe I'm doing 50 ruptured globes this year or something like that. You know, with the residents, they're faculty call. So they're not taking primary call, but they're doing a ton of, you know, that's just how busy our practice is.
Well, that's a great way of learning. Yeah, the ACGME number for cataracts that you required in residency is 86.
Yeah, I know. It's not very many.
So yeah. 300-400, that's great.
Yeah. Yeah, they get a lot of experience.
Now, do the residents rotate through your clinic as well, your private patients?
Yeah, they do. And it's funny how it works. A lot of times it's not the same resident in surgery that week as there are in clinic, but they do eventually, you know, get to see everything that I do pretty much. And then LASIK they get to see as well. LASIK's at a different location at their main hospital, and they'll see some of that as well. And then the cataracts they'll see at this location called Davie Hospital, which is run like an ASC, but it's technically a hospital. And that's where we have our catalyst laser, so they can see that or use that as well.
Wow. So they get hands-on and all this stuff when they're in residency.
Yeah. Yeah, they do. Yeah. They get to, what I like teaching residents and kind of blowing their mind. And I don't know if you know this about me, but I like to operate superior. I've gone back to superior for the last probably something like 20 years.
Could you, so the res- you make your phaco to superior, you make it temporal?
Temporal, superior.
Okay.
Every case.
So like every very case. European of you.
Yeah, I know, right? But, you know, it's funny. I give lectures about it, and I tell the residents, I said, you know, it's great you learn temporal if that's what you're comfortable with. But every now and then, somebody's got something going on over there. You can't operate temporal, and maybe it's an old ulcer or an old infection, and you got to learn how to operate superior. And they're always intimidated by doing that. But once they do it, it turns out there's more room up there than you think. If you think about it, we do LASIK superior. It's not that big a deal. And we do actually transplants, PKs, we've always done those superior. So there's really not that much of a transition. But if you, what I'll tell you this is what's interesting over the years is I've done a bunch of superior cataract surgery. I don't get iris prolapse up there, which is interesting, right? You just don't see iris prolapse. Now I'll make my paracentesis either nasal, you know, or temporal, and I'll get sometimes a little bit of prolapse through that tiny one, but not the main one up top ever. And isn't that, so I think it's because I'm entering in a little higher on the insertion of the iris root, whereas temporal, it's maybe a little bit more kind of slopes down like that. And so I think that's why it's prone. The other reason I notice it is I do another weird thing called corneal tattoos for covering iris defects. And I've never needed to cover a iris prolapse for a superior wound, but temporal ones I see all the time, especially on IOL exchanges. Whenever people do IOL exchanges, and they go through probably the previous wound, they always seem to get a little chafing of the iris. And if it's enough chasing, they'll get TIDs, and if that's enough, then they'll get the edge glare. So I end up doing a lot. I notice I'm doing these, corneal tattoos that cover up the temporal iris, but I never see that superiorly. The only thing I do tattoo wise superiorly is like PIs, they'll sometimes be symptomatic from that. So I like it for lack of iris prolapse. Ergonomically, I can sit at the head of the scope every single time. I don't have to switch the scope back and forth. I got plenty of room for my knees. I'm just straddling the head every single time. I think it's a tighter wound up there. The only wound leaks I've ever had personally have been temporal, and I do the same exact wound, but I think superior, they're less likely to rub it. Because if you're going to rub your eye, you might be doing this, but you're not digging up there. I think they feel it less because, you blink 10,000 times a day, so it's covered by your lid. You're not running it up and down the temporal wound. So all those kind of things roll it up to one. I just ended up becoming a superior surgeon. I operated temporal the other day because there was, we had Tarian, so I couldn't, there was too thin a cornea up there, so I had to move over. But most of the time it's always, and so the nurse is always like, oh my God, he's operating temporal. Because all the other faculty operate temporal like a normal person, not a weirdo like me. So when I operate temporal, they're like, what are you doing?
No, I travel a ton in Europe. It's super, I think it's more common to superior than it is a temporal.
Is that right?
Yeah. Almost all the surgeons there are just going to operate sitting superiorly. And then I guess the key there is just you got to get their chin up. That's especially important. When you operate superiorly, if their chin is tucked, you're going to have a hard time.
I haven't met a patient I couldn't do superior. I'll say that. Even deep set eyes. But you're right. The trick is to get the chin up out of, that way so that you're coming over the brow at a normal angle. And so that's always been the secret sauce to the formula to do it that way. But yeah, I like it. I think I'm going to stick. But it's funny. I give a lecture every now and talk about this. And it turns out, I think Eric Donnefeld told me he operated superior. And Carolina Rocha does it too. There's a few of us weirdos out there that still, and then I guess the European crowd that you met.
It's super common. It's like the most common way to operate is superior. Obviously, we learned that way. I mean, back in our day, we had to do extra caps before phaco.
We're doing sterile tunnels.
Right.
Yeah. And where were we operating? We're operating superior on those, right? Always. And, and I think I'll give a little credit temporally. You have more room, right, to make your incision. And then also you're inducing less cylinder, right, if you're operating temporally than you are superior. Superior, I can induce or reduce, depending on the axis of cylinder, about a half diopter. And temporally, you probably get zero or maybe 0.2 or something like that. Yeah. So that is for me, I'm a refractive cataract surgeon. If you want me to get rid of your astigmatism, I have plenty of ways to do that. I don't have to operate temporally to do that. I can operate superiorly and do paired arcuates at 0 and 180 if that's what it calls for, or an opposite one, or a toric, or whatever you want me to do. So I think I negate that argument that you should operate temporally, because it's funny, I gave a whole lecture one time, like I'm giving you right now, about operating superiorly. And then this guy comes up to me. He's like, I really like your presentation. I'm like, oh, thanks. He goes, you should operate temporally. I'm like, well, why? Like, why? Because it's just better. I'm like, okay, well, you go ahead and do that. I'll stick with my plan.
Yeah, I'm 98% temporal. On an unusual case, I'll do superior. I still actually do one a month for MSICS, the small incision, or the shelled incision manual extraction. I still do one.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what I'm trying to teach the residents too. And the fellows is like, there's usually a reason sometimes you have to operate superior. You should be comfortable doing it. Again, on these IOL exchanges, I honestly think they should go from temporal to superior, because I think you get into more trouble doing a lens exchange temporally through the same wound. Like I said, the iris prolapse, or sometimes the wounds don't jive, you didn't find that exact plane. You got to, we've seen some not so healthy looking IOL exchanges from that. And for me doing IOL exchange, I'm almost always, you know, doing it on some, I'm not trying to brag, but I'm usually doing it on somebody else's case. And so I just go superior, and it's been great to do it that way.
I actually like IOL exchange sitting superior as well, because I don't want to touch the prior incision. Like you were saying,
yeah.
You can open it. If you cross the incision, then you get some ratty looking cornea.
Yeah. Stick with that. I think that's a good idea.
So are you teaching them residents, like I said, manual extraction or extra cap or modern day extra cap? You doing that at all?
I don't, but my partner, Matt Gingak, I don't know if you know Matt, but he's a cornea specialist like me, and he's been on faculty at least 15, 16, maybe 20 years. He's been there for a while. He goes to Honduras two, three times a year as a mission trip. So he does a lot of M6 down there. But lately they've been starting to do some more phaco. But he's kind of always the one teaching the resident, the fellow, the M6 technique. He's really good at it. He's not as good as like some of those videos you see where they just like stab in and then it's like out, you know, like 4 second cataract removal.
Yeah.
But he's really good at it. So I have him take over on that.
Yeah. I once saw someone in India doing no joke, 10 of these an hour.
Yeah.
Boom, 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 boom. And it was like a ballet. It was so pretty to watch. And then you try to do it yourself. I'm like, and I got two left feet.
Yeah. They make it look easy, but I don't think it's that easy.
Yeah. There's a lot of subtleties. You know, any of these good surgeries, there's a lot of little subtleties.
Yeah, for sure.
It sounds like a great experience. And your residents can do LASIK too then with you, which is also unusual.
Yeah, more fellows do the LASIK. I mean, I've had some residents do LASIK or PRK, but it's always hard for them to find patients. And it's funny, you know, Uday, I even have a hard time getting them to do refractive cataract surgery. Like we have this Catalyst laser, they can do 10 cases, you know, no charge. It's all, you know, and I'll have out of the four residents, I might have one or two a year that do two or three cases. And I keep telling them, like, you know, this is probably what you're going to be doing in private practice. You're going to be doing some form of laser. It may not be this laser, maybe a lens AR, maybe something different, but you should have this, you know, under your belt, a little bit of experience, you know, before you head out. And they're just like, okay, Dr. Walter. I think they're just so infatuated with learning the basics of cataract surgery that right. They don't want to be overwhelmed with this whole other component of refractive cataract surgery. But if there is somebody that wants to learn it, you know, we had, I think, the resident last year who did a cornea fellowship. He wanted to do LASIK before he left, so he got some patients together. I guess the point is they have to be really motivated to find their own patients. I don't give them my private patients. And if they can find the right candidate and motivated, we'll get them trained up. The LASIK volumes kind of hurt us, too. We used to do more of that, but it's just less people wanting LASIK nowadays.
Yeah, nationwide, the numbers are down.
Yeah.
In my own practice, it's down significantly for sure.
Yeah. And that's what I've heard lots of my colleagues have said. So I don't know if it's like the ICL business is one theory I've heard is that people put in ICLs and, you know, marketing ICLs saying, you know, ICLs better than LASIK or even smile better than LASIK. Then they patients get confused with which they should have, or maybe they come in for a LASIK eval. And they're like, oh, I want LASIK. I'm like, oh, no, you should have an ICL, but it's, you know, twice as much. It's $8,000 instead. And then they're like, oh, I can't afford that. Never mind. And then maybe I'll wait and save up for it. So I've heard that argument, like we're bait and switching people or confusing them. And so people are just like, I'll just stick with contacts until we figure this out. I don't know if you feel any of that, but I think it's kind of interesting that some people have said that. And I thought that maybe.
I was surprised. I had a patient who was a good candidate for a phakic IOL. And then they came to get some research and they said, I can't have it because it has porcine tissue in it. I was like, what? I Googled it. I put it in ChatGPT. It does. I mean, I'll have to do more research on this, but I was just like, well, I had no idea. Porcine. Yeah, if you Google it or ChatGPT, it has porcine collagen apparently.
Is that how they make it? That the collamer is.
I'm not sure exactly how it's done, but I mean, a patient told me this, and then I didn't know if is that correct or not, so I put it in ChatGPT, Google Gemini, and it says yeah.
Their religion probably wouldn't let them. They're Jewish or.
Well, I didn't ask. I just yeah, probably, if, you, yeah. if it's not for you, it's not for you. But I know. I felt like so dumb. I didn't know this.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. You just educated me. Huh.
Well, if it's wrong, it may be ChatGPT hallucinating. But I actually did both. I did ChatGPT and I did Google Gemini. And both came up with kind of the same answer. Like, wait a minute.
They both can't be wrong.
Well, who knows? Who knows the world we're in now? Well, I've used the AI stuff to do like help me kind of make an outline of a paper or some article I want to write. And it's pretty good, but some of it's like, no, there's some serious editing required.
Yeah. I've done that too. But it's fascinating how well it works. Or, sometimes you go to Google and if you just do the basic Google, like we used to do all the searches, you get all these ads, for stuff you're not interested. You just want to answer to a question. And if you go to ChatGPT, it's like bam, it gives you the answer without any of that BS, which I like that part of it a lot. Just even something simple. Like I was buying a new golf bag. I was
Okay.
like, oh, there's gotta be a coupon code for this golf bag. And if you go on regular search, you get all this crazy, and none of them work. But I went to ChatGPT, and it was like, try these three. These have been known to work, and they were like, boom, $75 off. I was like, this is great.
Yeah, that's just because the companies haven't started to put ads in there yet. Well, wait, it's coming. Remember, Google searches used to not have ads. Now the first three things say little ad next to them, right?
That's
It's
right.
coming. You better enjoy the ad-free experience now because it's coming.
Or we're gonna have to. Well, my wife already, she loves ChatGPT. She's paying the $20 a month to use it unlimited or whatever advanced stuff. So maybe that's what we'll all be doing, is we'll just be paying,
Yeah, it's funny. It's how kids study these days too. It's how medical students study. They feed it, hear my lectures, hear my notes, hear the videos, make me some quizzes, and go ahead and quiz me.
That's awesome.
It's just like, wow, it's a different world.
Yeah, that's great.
It's a different world. So yeah, plus we actually a friend of mine, John Lattice, who's an ophthalmologist as well, developed an AI for doing IOL calcs.
Oh, really?
Yeah, interesting. And got US patents on it.
Wow, that's interesting.
It's a different world, and that's super interesting.
Yeah. That is interesting. Yeah, that would I would like yeah, I would like to just to feed AI a bunch of information, topography. Is that what he's talking about? Like all that stuff, and then just say, select the IOL for me.
Right. I mean, we're not quite there yet, but I'm have a feeling it's gonna come. Even easier, just extract it from the medical record.
Right. Just tell me what this patient wants. Oh, they'd like to stay -3. You leave it or aim -3 with this lens.
Right. I think we'll end up getting there. And as you know, we're even down there's AI component to the robotic category that we recently did.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, it's just wild. It's so wild. It's like the future is gonna be unbelievable. The amount of toys we're gonna get.
Yeah. If
It's
we can keep this, it's off topic. If we can keep this country intact.
yeah, that's the tough part. Who knows? Well, I have a solution for that. I don't check the news anymore. I just can't be bothered. I got
You
stuff going on. I can't be bothered.
don't know that we own Venezuela and Greenland yet?
Gotcha. I'm out of the loop. I'm out of everybody on my drive over today. I was using a Google Gemini in the car. I was like, tell me about the research papers published by Keith Walter.
Oh my gosh, really?
They just spitting them out. I was like, oh, that's an interesting one. Really?
Gosh.
That's why I got my notes here.
That's how he knows me. Oh no, I'm known to the AI world.
Oh, that's another one too. Ask it, what do you know about me? Because you're logged into your Google account, or you're logged in your chat account, like your wife's account. What do you know about me? You'll be shocked.
Really? I haven't done that yet.
No, I don't know if you want to. Sometimes ignorance is bliss. But anyway, before we dive too far off topic, I just want to thank you. We've been talking for, gosh, come on, an hour here.
Are we already?
I
Oh my
50
gosh, that's
minutes.
right.
I certainly appreciate the expertise and the incredible history lesson about LASIK and refractive surgery. That's something that the young generation who loves this podcast will really need to learn about.
Well, that's good. Yeah. It's good to know where you've come from and where you're headed.
Yeah, and how lucky we are today to have it at this state of the art. Unbelievable.
It is amazing. I even it's so one more little pearl that if they're, I think Gary Wartz has talked about this too, but I don't use a lens for YAG lasers.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you do, but I haven't done it in a long time, but it's so funny because a lot of our residents are taught to use the Abram lens, with YAG lasers. And I stopped doing it, way back when I was worried about using that lens
on a PK patient, I would suck the PK off the eye, you know, because it sometimes sucks on there so good. And I just started doing it without. And I looked into the history of YAG lasers. And it turns out, like, when they first came out in, like, the 80s, there was only, like, a 3% adoption rate because they were expensive. They're, like, 50 grand back then, which is, I don't know, 500 grand nowadays. And you could take a 10-cent needle, stab it in the eye, and scrape the capsule and break it open, and that you'd be done. So there was a study published in 1985. It was published comparing results with a needle technique versus the new fancy YAG laser.
Yep.
And guess what this article said?
The needle's better.
Needle's better. Less complication, more success, all that stuff. And, but again, it's come a long way, right? Those original YAG lasers weren't very focused very well. The energy wasn't right. You know, all the technology that's come into play since then, and you probably did need an Abram lens on every single one of those. And then I keep trying to tell the residents, like, I know some of the faculty are still telling you to use that Abram lens, but you really don't need to. Like, yeah. It's the technology's gotten so much better. And of course, back then we were doing extra caps, and so they were probably leaving a lot of cortex behind, and the capsules were really thick. And I bet you the laser didn't go through that well back then.
Yeah,
all those problems, but a needle did.
So I first started my practice in 2000, and I couldn't afford the YAG laser, right? And yeah. So what I ended up doing was I'd rent it, and they bring it in the truck basically to my clinic.
Yeah,
and I'd pay per hour. So I would book as many patients as possible. I'd book like 20 patients for that 1 hour, line them all dilated, and then laser them, boom, boom, boom. So I'd never use a lens either because I got to get them done in this 1 hour.
Yeah, yeah. Well, lens is a mess. It's like gooey stuff coming down their face. They're tearing like crazy. They're like all apprehensive with this thing in there. And sometimes it causes an abrasion. You know, no thanks.
Back in the, at least the YAG is a good laser because there's no click fees.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Now, any new laser, look at the new glaucoma lasers, click fee.
Even the new cross-linking machine that's coming out, there's a huge click fee with that. I don't know if you've heard, it's like crazy. I don't know how it's all going to work, but it's, I don't want to say exactly, but I think it's around $70,000.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Yes.
The way Glaukos is doing it, apparently, is if it's not covered by insurance, whatever's not covered, they're gonna pay the rest of the portion for it. So I don't know if it's just a way to get maximum amount of money out of insurance, but it's kind of a little nutty.
Yeah, who knows how it'll all pan out. Oh, the only thing that goes down in cost or down in price is our surgeon fees.
Yeah, for sure. That's bad. When's it gonna be negative?
Yeah, exactly. I got to go do surgery. I need to take some money out of the bank so I can go pay and do surgery. Well, you know, the problem is they're going to find out how much we actually love doing surgery.
Yeah.
That's the issue. We love doing it. I mean, look, we do these charity trips to other countries and do it for free all day, right? We love it.
Yeah. They got us. They know what we're all about. They know what they can pay us nothing. We'll do it.
But, you know, I'm sure you feel the same way, though. I'm thankful every day to be an ophthalmologist. This was the best career decision ever, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I remember in high school hearing about ophthalmology and radial keratotomy, you know, Fyodorov doing RK when I was in high school. That's how old I am. And I thought, oh, I wear contacts. That'd be amazing to make people see again, you know? And I was like, you know, -3 or whatever. I just thought I needed to have RK immediately. And then I want to see what doctor does that. And turns out it's an ophthalmologist, and turns out they go to med school. I was learning all this from high school. And then I came home and I told my brother, who's 10 years older than me, I said, I want to be an ophthalmologist when I grow up. He's like, you're not smart enough. That's what he told me.
Well,
that was motivating.
Yeah, for some. Yeah, for no, for sure. No, I think I found out just by dumb luck. I just had to be end of my third year of med school, and I had like, okay, I got an extra block. Let me do this rotation. Let me see what it's about.
Yeah.
And it was so cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Patient with bilateral white cataracts has this beautiful, elegant surgery, even back then in the 90s.
Yeah.
And like, normal.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just amazing. It was amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. But who gets to do that? Us. We get to do that. It's great. It's a great specialty for sure.
It is for sure. Well, again, thank you so much. I'll put this podcast up. It'll be up in February. All the young adults certainly love to listen to it. I'm sure your residents are going to be listening to it as well.
Yeah, they'll be surprised. I haven't told them anything about it, so they'll be surprised.
That will surprise them. Don't worry.
Yeah. All right.
Thanks again. I want to remind our listeners and our viewers, remember, we got a new Catter Coach podcast every single Sunday. Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, and where you find a podcast, you find the Catter Coach podcast. And, of course, we have a new Catter Coach video of the day every day. We're at 2,800-something videos and counting. Until next time, I'll catch you later.